Morning, Chief Justice Steele. Chris Singwald of White & Williams on behalf of the appellants, Ford Motor Company and General Motors Corporation. I'd like to introduce my co-counsel who have been admitted pro hoc vice, Eileen Penner and Andrew Tauber.
It's our custom to rise when you introduce to the court. Thank you.
Ms. Penner will be presenting oral argument today on behalf of Ford and General Motors.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning, Justices. My name is Eileen Penner. I represent appellants General Motors and Ford Motors Corporations.
Counsel, I'm having trouble hearing you. Can you speak into the mic?
This court held in Money v. Manville Corporation that, quote, asbestos products are not generic, unquote. As the court explained in Money, a plaintiff may not ask a jury to simply assume that because some asbestos products create a risk of disease, that all asbestos products necessarily do. The question here, therefore, is whether friction products, which contain refined chrysotile that has been milled, heated, and embedded in resin, caused Mr. Grenier's mesothelioma. For plaintiff's expert testimony that such friction products do cause mesothelioma to be admissible, under this court's decisions, under Daubert, those opinions needed to be both relevant and reliable. And the U.S. Supreme Court explained in General Electric versus Joyner that an opinion that a particular substance causes a particular disease is only relevant and reliable if there is a strong fit between the data underlying that opinion and the opinion itself. And the court explained that there needs to be scientific reliability supporting each link in the chain of logic from data to conclusion. That link, the linkage between the data on which these experts relied and their conclusions that friction products cause mesothelioma was lacking here because the data on which they relied concerned almost exclusively data from non-friction products. In this case, the plaintiffs had a very serious problem. As plaintiffs' own epidemiologist expert, who also was their causation expert, testified, there was no epidemiology showing that exposure to friction products increased the risk of contracting mesothelioma. It's not that the studies had never been done. The studies had been done by among the most reputable research institutions in the world. And each time that it had been studied, not once, not twice, but 16 times, they had concluded that while they were able to document an increase in risk of mesothelioma from exposure to non-friction products through work such as insulation, which Mr. Grenier also did, they were unable to document any increased risk whatsoever from exposure to friction products through work as an auto mechanic or a brake mechanic. So how were the plaintiffs going to prove that friction products cause disease in light of this dearth of any evidence, statistical evidence, supporting their position? What they did is they reached over to the evidence concerning non-friction products and said, well, non-friction products cause disease, and they brought a lot of evidence into court there. That is a fundamental lack of fit between the data on which the experts are relying and the conclusions that they're offering that friction products cause disease. Just to go through, sort of to get a list in one's mind of the categories of evidence on which they relied, they had an unsupported assumption that refined chrysotile in friction products that has been milled, heated, and embedded in resin acts exactly the same way as fibers that are completely raw chrysotile fibers, notwithstanding that they admitted that they had never looked at that to find out whether it was true, and they conceded that there were several reasons to believe it was not true. Number two, they relied on case reports, incidents of auto mechanics who happened to have gotten mesothelioma, but they didn't attempt to control for exposures to other forms of asbestos, and it turns out that's really...
Counsel, at least we're told from the other side's brief that underlying your position are two assumptions. One is that the epidemiological evidence is clear, that there's no causal relationship, no demonstrated causal relationship between friction product exposure and mesothelioma. And number two, that evidence trumps whatever contrary evidence there might be on that question. Is that a correct characterization of your position?
It is not, Your Honor. We do not rely either on the position that the epidemiology must be perfect, nor do we rely on the position that epidemiology always trumps other forms of evidence. The question that we submit for the court...
Well, are you claiming that it trumps in this case?
In this case, the epidemiological evidence is powerful and it cannot be irrelevant, but the court can decide. I would submit that the lack of fit between the data on which these experts relied and their conclusion alone compels exclusion of their testimony. When it is viewed in light of the uniform, abundant contrary epidemiology by 16 research institutions across the country using different methodologies, different populations at different times, the unreliability of the forms of evidence that they used is so stark that it is confirmed.
So the second assumption is correct. The epidemiology evidence is consistent with your position.
The plaintiffs agree. Their plaintiffs' own expert epidemiologist testified.
Is that a yes or a no?
I may be misunderstanding the assumption, but if the assumption is that the epidemiology all goes our way, they agree with that.
And that is your position.
It's their position as well. Their epidemiology.
Is it your position?
That the epidemiology all goes our way? Yes. Justice Jacobs, it is our position.
The court found that the epidemiology evidence was equivocal, and it didn't go all the way, and that it really depends on how you interpret that evidence, and that the picture was much more cloudy than it's been argued to us. What is your response?
I interpret Judge Seitz's opinion regarding the epidemiology somewhat different, Justice Jacobs. He was saying not that the epidemiology, at least I did not read his opinion, to say that the epidemiology supported the opposing position, which would have been directly contrary to the testimony of the plaintiff's own epidemiologist. I read it to say that he credited that epidemiologist's criticisms about the epidemiology, which Dr. Lemon, their causation expert, testified at trial, rendered the epidemiology, quote, equivocal. But I would submit to Your Honor that the court does not need to decide this. The evidence is very strong, and I would like to address the power of the epidemiological evidence. But the court does not need to decide this case on the basis of the strength of the epidemiological evidence. Looking solely at the plaintiff's own evidence, the question whether the data underlying their opinions fit with the conclusions that they rendered, it did not. The tissue burden studies, it couldn't be confirmed whether the fibers they drew from tissue were refined chrysotile or raw chrysotile. The animal studies explicitly did not use friction fibers. The case reports, they did not control for exposure to other forms of asbestos. In each of these instances, it's a disregard for the essential proposition that this court was setting forth in Money, which is each asbestos product has to be proved to cause disease. And that is particularly true in a case such as this, where there is epidemiology, the very same epidemiology that shows that not friction products are not associated with mesothelioma is the epidemiology that shows that non-friction products are, on which these plaintiffs' experts are relying. The epidemiology studied shipbuilders and people who worked with insulation and people who worked with all manner of non-friction products. In each of these studies, they confirmed, notwithstanding that mesothelioma is a rare disease, they confirmed that there was an increased risk of mesothelioma from exposure to those non-friction products. But when they specifically looked at the question whether auto mechanics or brake mechanics had a higher risk of disease, each time the answer was no. Dr. Lemon, the epidemiologist, as you noted, Justice Jacobs, did have criticisms about some of the studies, but I would submit it is not sufficient for an expert to come into court and quibble about this study or that study. Dr. Lemon conceded that there is no possibility of doing perfect epidemiology. He did not try to do better. Instead, what he did was he took the epidemiology as a whole, and he said over the years, three, four decades, I've been able to count up 165 case reports instances in which auto mechanics have gotten mesothelioma. That's a really big number because mesothelioma is a rare disease. So there must be a causal connection. That is not science. That is not reliable. It ignored, utterly ignored, the fact that these very same case reports had already been documented to be people who had had exposures to other known toxic forms of asbestos.
Help us by relating your argument to the standard of review. As you know, the United States Supreme Court has said you review a Daubert ruling for abuse of discretion, and we've adopted that standard in Delaware. And we have the Superior Court exercising its discretion to let the evidence in, and quoting the language from Daubert, it said, and the better way to deal with this is through rigorous, vigorous cross-examination. How specifically did the Superior Court abuse its discretion?
Justice Holland, we believe that the linchpin to the error in Judge Sleight's decision was in his belief that it was okay to rely on evidence for different kinds of asbestos and different products because someone had testified that friction and non-friction fibers were indistinguishable. First, no one testified to that. It didn't happen. And what actually happened was that Dodson, the microscopist, testified that he had looked at a friction fiber from a break under a very high-powered microscope and had seen that it looked morphologically the same as another chrysotile fiber. In other words, its physical structure was. But Dr. Dodson and Dr. Lemon both testified that two key factors that affect the bioactivity of a fiber, its ability to cause disease, are surface structure and surface chemistry.
Right, going back to the standard of review, we have cases that say one way to demonstrate an abuse of discretion is if the ruling is based on either an inaccurate factual assumption or an improper consideration. That seems to be the way you're going, that the court exercised its discretion based on an erroneous premise. Is that correct?
That's correct. I would also submit that Judge Sleights erred in placing too much weight on the notion that if you have a body of evidence that says friction fibers have no causal relationship whatsoever to mesothelioma, and non-friction fibers do have a causal relationship. If you think about it logically, coming into court and saying, well, the friction products cause mesothelioma because non-friction products do, in the face of that uniform contrary evidence, you would have to be able to know the precise disease-causing mechanism of a fiber and to be able to prove that it is identical in friction and non-friction fibers for your evidence to be relevant, because otherwise to say, well, they kind of look the same under a microscope, yeah, but we have a whole body of epidemiology over here that has been unable to find any association whatsoever. Yes?
Well, complete your answer.
We believe that it's a clear abuse of discretion, both because it was contrary to the record and because it was a misunderstanding of what a sufficient fit under General Electric versus Joyner is, where the data actually have to support the conclusion that's being rendered. And if I may, just on the question of the error of fact, read to the court from the appendix at page 458. This is the question that was asked. After Dr. Dodson conceded that surface charge and surface chemistry do affect the ability of a fiber to cause disease, and Dr. Lemon testified to the same thing, Dr. Dodson was asked, and in the fibers that you analyzed, again, you weren't able to or you didn't undertake to try to analyze the surface charge or the surface chemistry, right? Answer, no, sir, unquote. And that's at the appendix.
Okay, so your legal argument in response to Justice Holland's question is that the court rested its conclusion on an erroneous assumption. That was the abuse of discretion, correct?
That is one of two components of the abuse of discretion. Right. The second is a misunderstanding of how much fit is required between the data and the conclusion.
All right. But as to the first, that argument itself is premised on a secondary argument that the assumption was factually wrong. That is, you're asking You're saying that the Supreme Court, the Superior Court, made an erroneous finding of fact, which we have to overturn. That is embedded in your abuse of discretion argument.
That's correct.
The only way that that could happen would be if there is no evidence, none, to support a finding, a possible finding, that there is no essential dissimilarity between fibers from friction and non-friction products. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor. And as I would like to explain, we have a body of evidence with regard to friction fibers, okay, and friction products. And the studies all show that there's no connection with an increased risk of mesothelioma. There is evidence that non-friction fibers are associated with mesothelioma. In light of that evidence, in order for somebody to say friction products must cause mesothelioma because all this evidence about non-friction products says that they do, you would have to be able to either know the precise mechanism of a fiber that causes disease, which is almost unknowable, and certainly everyone at trial testified that it was unknowable, in order to be able to say that you had thoroughly examined that and now all of a sudden the non-friction product evidence was relevant. But in this case, that wasn't even an issue, because when asked whether he had even tried to assess the question, Dr. Dodson, as I read to the court, explicitly said no. He had not tried to analyze it. And it isn't just pinning it on one question and answer in the testimony. If you looked at Dr. Dodson's reports, which are in the appendix, he does not purport to have looked at these key questions that he testified affect the bioactivity of an asbestos fiber. I would submit that in order to prove the risk of a friction product through evidence solely concerning non-friction products, you would have to know a tremendous amount about the way fibers work and how disease is caused. No one professed to know that, and our answer to figuring out whether a substance causes a disease absent that kind of specific information, which is almost always the case, is we use the gold standard of causation in science, which is epidemiology. We study the product.
But what you call the gold standard is basically a statistical methodology.
It is
as distinguished from an individual case methodology. Is that right?
That's correct, Justice Steele. And Dr. Lemon, the causation expert at trial, testified that the statistical methodology supersedes case reports when it is well done. It is uniformly accepted by scientists and courts.
Let's stop for a minute. We're talking about mesothelioma. It appears to have been undisputed by anybody that the only cause of mesothelioma is asbestos. Correct? You don't need a statistical study to conclude that.
That is inconsistent with the record, Justice Jacobs. The record actually reflects Dr. Lemon testified that 20% of all mesotheliomas cannot be attributed to any identified asbestos exposure.
And
Dr. Dodson did as well.
And the other 80% is attributable to asbestos?
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's a pretty high number, isn't it?
There are two possible explanations for someone getting three possible explanations for somebody getting mesothelioma. They were exposed to a toxic form of asbestos. They were part of the background rate of 20% of people who might be secretaries or office workers who have no known exposure to asbestos who get mesothelioma, or there is a theory out there that it may be that some people may be getting mesothelioma from exposure to radiation. But the key point here is that Dr. Lemon premised his testimony based on case reports rather than any epidemiology of his own. He extracted these incidents of people getting mesothelioma, which are merely anecdotes unless you actually study the statistical significance.
Well, you call them anecdotes. Others refer to them as individual case studies.
Individual case studies which have not been controlled for other exposures. And on this record, that was a key point that was undisputed. The Spiritus study showed that 55% of all auto mechanics in the studied group also had done work, like Mr. Grenier himself, with insulation on boilers, an incredibly high risk for exposure to the most toxic forms of asbestos. 33% of auto mechanics in the studied group had worked in shipyards. Again, huge exposure to the most toxic forms of asbestos. Dr. Lemon's opinion was predicated on the fact that 165 is a really big number, notwithstanding that that number had been drawn from the epidemiological studies that when exposure to other forms of asbestos like shipyard work and boiler work were controlled for, showed no greater incidence of mesothelioma in comparison with the background rate. I'd also like to talk briefly about the reference to Bradford Hill criteria.
You're aware you're in your rebuttal time?
I am, Your Honor. Okay. If I may, for just one moment.
Sure. It's up to you.
The Bradford Hill criteria were referenced repeatedly at trial as some kind of justification for reliance on forms of evidence that typically are not relied upon to show causation, like case reports that Dr. Lemon testified typically are superseded by well-controlled epidemiology, animal studies using the wrong kinds of fibers, and so on. The Bradford Hill criteria, by their own terms, are for studying the meaning of a statistical association once it is identified. And this appears in the appendix of the plaintiff's amicus at pages 1590 and 1591. The factual predicate for the relevance of the Bradford Hill criteria is that a statistical association exists. It is not, as the plaintiffs endeavor to use it, a justification for not finding no statistical association in the first instance. This notion is also addressed in the recent Pennsylvania Court of Common Pleas decision that we provided to the court earlier this week. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Michael Weiss. I and Yvonne Seville are local counsel for the appellee in this matter. I'd like to introduce Kevin McCarg, who has been admitted pro hac vice and who will be presenting arguments on behalf of appellee. And also Renee Malacone, who is also present and has also been admitted pro hac vice.
May it please the court. Thank you for allowing me to appear before you, Pro Hoc Vice, and thank you for the book. I've never gotten a gift from a court before. That's very kind. I want to start with, I think there's an important point, and Justice, you raised it, which is that we need to start from the standard of review and talk about what this court is really here to decide today. And I think I'm going to get specific in a minute to try to explain that the caricature that's been presented here doesn't bear any resemblance to the actual proceeding that Judge Slides conducted or the actual decisions he made. But I want to talk a little bigger picture, because there's actually two levels that I think are important that are completely skipped over every time we have this argument. And I've had this argument with lots and lots of people around the country for automotive defendants, and it always, they just cut right to, we want to talk about surface chemistry. But I want to step back a minute and talk about the two levels that are going on here. Number one, as you've noted, this court is not sitting to decide any of these fact questions, any of these ultimate questions of credibility or of admissibility. It's here to review whether the judges below abused their discretion. In other words, whether they acted arbitrarily and capriciously without conscience or reason in reaching these decisions. And we'll talk about why I think that standard precludes the arguments that the Ford and GM are making. But even Judge Slights, who was sitting as the trial court with the full discretion, even he was not exercising discretion over these questions of fact or over these links in the chain. And I just have to dispute for a moment this idea that the defendants have presented today that Daubert or this court's rulings authorize a trial court to basically make findings of fact at every step of a process that may have multiple steps supporting an opinion about causation in toxic tort case. There's just no support for that. And the actual standard is that you're looking at the totality of the support and the foundation for the opinion and deciding whether, not whether it's true or correct or credible or even better than the alternative, but whether it's based on the kind of reliable scientific method that those experts would use outside the courtroom. And on that point, there's just no question. So I think Michael Green is he edited the Federal Reference Guide in Epidemiology, and he's the reporter for the third restatement on products liability. And I cite the third restatement in the brief quite a bit because it's a really important point. It's a comment devoted to toxic substances because these issues, I sympathize with this court, these issues come up all the time, and they're difficult, and they produce a lot of paper. But what Michael Green did, he's one of the pioneers of what we think of now as Daubert, went in with the National Academy of Sciences and collaborated on this comment to try to help clarify some of these issues. And what they said was there is a common mistake to approach epidemiological data as though it yields a single answer, and once the epidemiology has spoken, it's the gold standard, and no one can disagree. And what the comment says, as we quote in our brief, is that's not accurate. It's not even a real statement about what epidemiology does. And reasonable scientists can and do differ on whether a body of data supports or negates or is inconclusive on a causal relationship. And right now, all over the world, scientists, perfectly reasonable scientists, following reliable methodologies, disagree on whether friction products or other products or Christ-style asbestos in general is a cause of mesothelioma. And there's a disagreement about that has to be resolved at trial. And I want to clarify another point here, which is that the usual false dichotomy is here's all this epidemiology on friction products and none on the other side. Well, let's clarify. There's no such thing as epidemiology on friction products. It doesn't exist. The council said, and I'll quote here, we have study after study from exposure to friction products. That's not true. None of those studies that are cited, and we'll talk about it in a minute, how it shrinks from 16 to 1.5 when you actually clarify what they're talking about, none of those were friction product studies. Those are studies of broad job classifications that may have included garage workers or brake mechanics or vehicle mechanics or whatever category. That's a reasonably good proxy, but as counsel just said, there's a lot of overlap in these categories. And if you start throwing out everybody who's done something else, you're going to get to a sample size ultimately that doesn't tell you much of anything. And this is actually an important point here, that we're not really talking about one side embraces epidemiology and the other side is off doing some weird rogue science that doesn't connect to epidemiology. There's a job title, job classification-driven epidemiology that's very useful from a public health perspective for identifying high-risk occupations. It tells NIOSH where to put their resources. It's a useful tool. It's certainly part of the picture. I've never tried to exclude one of these studies, even the ones paid for by the defendants. But what they don't tell you is what the product exposure is or how that exposure relates to disease. The exposure-driven studies, and we cite the Iwatsubo study as an example, and Dr. Lemon talked about it quite a bit, cut across job classifications and look at levels of exposure. And what they're trying to ascertain is, are you exposed to the substance of interest? And we'll talk for a minute about the distinctions in a minute. Are you exposed to the substance, and at what levels, and at what levels do you start to see risk? You can track the increase in risk as you get to levels. And then the approach when you're going from the exposure-based epidemiology is, let's identify, if you're looking at individual case, did this person have an occupational exposure that would put you in the range where you would be a concern for a disease like mesothelioma, or in the case of benzene, which this court just affirmed, a panel of this court just affirmed, of leukemia. Because benzene is used in all different concentrations and all different products, but you can look at the exposure and ascertain whether it has a causal relationship. Can you do it mathematically and perfectly and come back with a piece of litmus paper that says, yes, it caused it? No. But let me talk for a minute about what counsel was focusing on. So the contest here is not between science and non-science. It's between different epidemiologists using completely uncontroversial accepted methods used in the field to analyze a question of causation, and that question, if reasonable minds can differ in our system, is submitted to a jury. But I want to talk for a minute about this idea of fit, because I disagree at the higher level, at the broad level, about whether that's even a good legal question to say the judge should be fact-finding at each stage rather than determining whether the scientists are relying on a reliable methodology. But even let's get down to the molecular level now. Let's talk about it really close up. The most of the attributes they talk about with friction products, the length of the fibers, are attributes of chrysotile in general. The fact that they're refined is true of thousands of products that use refined chrysotile.
The fact that they're embedded is addressed in the studies, both by the defendants, by NIOSH, and by Dr. Longo that were testified to, about what happens to the fibers when you grind them and sand them and how they're released. So this idea that they're all just nicely encapsulated and never get out is not true, is not consistent with the record. The record is that the testing, no one really disagrees with, is that the use of these products as they're intended to be used releases respirable fibers. So that brings us to surface chemistry, which you can read the length and breadth of asbestos literature and you will not find the idea that every scientist out there, before they say anything about asbestos, is going to do tests on the surface chemistry of the fiber isn't borne out by the literature. That doesn't relate to anything that scientists are talking about. What the testimony they're quoting, they asked Dr. Lemon about some studies mainly of cows and of how fibers work in cow alveoli, and he said, yes, that's a potential factor. In some studies it increases, in some studies it decreases cytotoxicity, which is potentially a step toward carcinogenesis, but it's a factor that's worth studying. But counsel for the defense said, just so we're clear, on page 505, I'm not asking you based on that study or any of the studies whether to conclude there's affirmative proof that friction fibers are rendered inert. That's not what I'm asking you to do. So this brings me back to the larger point.
Let me stop you there.
Sure.
For a minute. It appears that a critical distinction upon which the appellant's position rests is the distinction between fibers from friction and from non-friction products. Is your position that is not a valid distinction, or that it is a valid distinction, but one that doesn't matter? I mean, where are we analytically?
Well, let me approach that from. I think whether that distinction matters is a factual dispute. I don't think that there is a conclusive. I can't stand here and say, as a matter of law, no one can question the distinction between commercial Cristile in general and Cristile and friction products. The evidence at trial is, and it's not disputed, is that GM friction products were up to 75% asbestos, Ford were up to 60% Cristile asbestos. And the distinctions I'm talking about, the question is not whether there are distinctions. There were thousands of applications that used commercial Cristile. They all had different, even bags of pure Cristile sold by some people were refined in some way, and there's disputes about how that affected them. But my point is, there may be distinctions. There are always going to be distinctions between different products and how things are used in different products. And
let me ask you about distinctions. And you have been referring to exposure quite a bit, and exposure is relevant. In your brief, you attached Judge Sleight's opinion, where he characterized Dr. Hammer's testimony, and he quotes from Dr. Hammer. And Dr. Hammer was asked why he disagreed with Chrysler's position. And at the end, Dr. Hammer is quoted as saying, "So here, I see the case of a person who we have good evidence that was the only exposure they had." Then he goes on to conclude there had to be a causal effect. Am I reading Dr. Hammer's his quote correctly, that he's saying this is a case where the only exposure was to a friction product, therefore, I conclude that's the source of his current condition?
Are you asking if that's what Dr. Hammer and
is that what Dr. Hammer said?
I think it is absolutely what he said. And what he meant was, and I agree with defendants, that's an atypical case. You will not usually find that pristine, but it is a good test case when you have that's the only exposure.
But he's talking
that links
about our
up.
Case, is that correct?
No, he's the I don't believe he's talking about.
Well,
are you talking about Mr. Grenier?
Let's relate it to our
Judge,
our
yeah,
case.
Judge Slice was talking about it, was doing a global hearing on this.
Right. So what he was saying is that we could isolate it to a pristine case where that was your only exposure, you'd have a correlation.
He wasn't saying that's the only way you'd have a correlation. He was saying that is stronger evidence. That's strong evidence that the correlation exists when it exists in that case. That doesn't mean that any case where there's other exposure is not a correlation.
All right. Well, let's relate that testimony back to this case, where we had some evidence that this particular plaintiff had been exposed to non-friction products. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, although it wasn't raised in the opening remarks, help this court understand why the argument in the opening brief about the non-disclosed evidence of the other lawsuit based on non-friction products was not reversible error. As we read their brief, they say, our whole theory was this particular plaintiff was not simply exposed to these friction products, he was also exposed to non-friction products. And our theory of the case was that it was the non-friction products that probably contributed or caused this condition, and that if we'd known about that undisclosed evidence, we would have made a more effective argument to the jury.
I'm so glad you brought that up. And let me clarify just first a technical point. It's not an other lawsuit. It was a bankruptcy trust administrative claim form that was made.
Just so we understand the record, as I read the record, your client said under oath in the bankruptcy proceeding that they were entitled to compensation because of what's put in quotes in the brief, meaningful exposure to non-friction products. So you don't want to call it a lawsuit. I'll call it an allegation in a judicial bankruptcy proceeding that I'm entitled to recovery because of my exposure to non-friction products. Is that what your client did?
Right. But my client sued non-friction products in this lawsuit and filed a petition saying I'm entitled to recovery from lots of different manufacturers. It is no part of our case and never has been part of our case that his recovery is contingent on them being the sole cause of his disease. It is a cumulative exposure disease, and there are multiple exposures. And I want to put this into context because this is an important point. He swore under oath on his work history sheets that he was exposed to page after page of products. The defendants were under no illusion about the other products to which he was exposed and the way he was exposed. And they went on and on about it at trial.
I understand that. But the point they're trying to make in their brief, and this is why I want to give you a chance to address it, is that notwithstanding the fact that you acknowledged he had been exposed, and notwithstanding the fact that that was available, that they were unaware, according to them, of the fact that he had submitted this claim, and that if they had been aware of the allegations in the claim he submitted, it would have supported their case, and they could have more effectively presented their case to the jury. They're saying the existence of the claim form is quantitatively different than simply saying I was exposed, because what he said in the bankruptcy proceeding is I was exposed and I'm entitled to recovery.
Right, and I maybe didn't clarify how the bankruptcy trusts work. When you say you're entitled to recovery, that does not mean that you're showing some greater exposure than you would show in a courtroom. If you look at the trust documents, even for diseases like asbestosis, they may require 6 months of exposure. For mesothelioma, it's not even that. The definitions are company exposure, which means an affidavit that you were present at a site where the product was used. And the reason for that is not because bankruptcy trusts are just pro-plaintiff. It's because the purpose of the trust is to create a streamlined process where no one has to litigate and you can submit it and then they can argue about the amount, but you're not working up the case. So the idea, it's fundamentally incorrect when they suggest that the bankruptcy claim contains some additional information that's not conveyed in it. And I'll give you, this is a great example, because, again, we're talking about abuse of discretion. Would they have done something differently? They had a bankruptcy claim, the exact kind of claim against Quigley, which made a refractory submit just like Harbison Walker. They never even tried to introduce it to the jury, never. They never thought it was important at all. It's the same kind of product, the same kind of exposure, the same kind of bankruptcy setup where you say it's meaningful. And what's interesting is in the reply brief they say, oh, well, we thought Quigley was a friction product. And let me just say to this court, Ford and General Motors have some familiarity with the automotive industry. They did not think that Quigley made a friction product. And in fact, if you look at the record, Mr. Singerwald, on the record, told the trial court, Quigley is a manufacturer of insulation. That's at B-266. They were under no illusions about Quigley. They knew exactly what Quigley made, and Quigley made the same thing Harbison Walker makes. And they couldn't have cared less. I mean, they included these products in this, and you can read the record, page B-313 to 314. They would list the products, look at all these non-friction products, and that's fine. That's a totally legitimate theory for them to present, that they list the products. All that would have been different in this case, if that claim form, which was I apologize for the error. It was not turned over. It was not, but I'm not going to get into the details of it, but that was unfortunate. But all that would be different is that long list on page 313, they would have listed Harbison Walker. And the idea that this jury, having heard, having seen all this evidence, and they kept, you can look at Mr. Singwall, he kept emphasizing, Mr. Grenier swore under oath that he was exposed to this and this, and they read the deposition, and that's, again, that's fine. But the idea that the addition of one more product, which was substantially the same as another bankruptcy claim, would have completely changed the verdict is very, very shaky. And if you're looking at whether the trial court was within her discretion not to order a whole new trial because of that document, the fact that they had all the underlying information already, the fact that they didn't do anything with other information that was substantially the same, the fact that it wasn't, and the trial court heard all of the evidence and heard how it went in.
So it's your position that he simply didn't list his exposures to these non-friction products. He acknowledged under oath that with regard to the entire list, he had been exposed to them in a meaningful way.
Well, the interrogatories don't use the word meaningful, but I don't think sworn interrogatories are meant to be meaningless. And the opposite of meaningless is meaningful. I mean,
it's a pretty voluminous record. I'm just trying to get
I would zero
to
in,
me understand the record.
That's a good
my
point.
My question is simple. And did he say that my exposure to this long list of products was meaningful?
The word meaningful does not appear in the interrogatories.
But he did say that with regard to the HW product.
I don't know that he said that. I think that the rules of the trust set criteria, and they define it as meaningful and credible evidence, and then in turn that's defined as evidence that you were present at the site where the product was used. So I think meaningful has to be read in the context of what the meaning was, and the meaning was essentially the same as the work history sheet, which is I was around this product when it was used. And it really, and I would invite the court to look, to read the claim form beginning to end and ask yourself if there was anything in there, even assuming, which is on its face, it's inadmissible, but assuming it had been admitted and the jury had taken it back and read it for days, there's nothing in there that would have pushed the jury any different direction than the rest of these 30 or 40 non-friction products that were identified as the other likely culprits. The fact of this man's life is he spent 3 decades doing brake work, up to 10 jobs a day, on brakes that are 75-80% asbestos. That's the fact of his life. And I would like to respond to go back to, I don't want to jump on.
One point of clarification, then I'll, you say there's this list, and that if you had disclosed the document that you admit you should have disclosed, but sure, it was not disclosed inadvertently, this would have just been something else on the list. But that with regard to everything else on the list, the record would show the same description as it does to HW. Or are the appellants really wrong when they say the HW exposure is distinguishable from everything else on the list because this is the only item that should have been on the list that had something connected to it that characterized the exposure as meaningful?
I don't think that's correct because the Quigley the bankruptcy trusts have similar standards for recovery. And I also think that the use of the word meaningful is not illuminating here.
I understand that. But my simple question, and I understand your explanation, is does this piece of paper, this bankruptcy claim for the HW product, distinguish it from everything else on the list? Or not?
Except for the other bankruptcy claims, it's distinguished because it's a bankruptcy claim and it uses somewhat different formulations than. But the underlying, and as we pointed out, the bankruptcy claims, they staple the work history sheets to the back. The underlying representation is exactly the same. And in fact, if you look at when they list their distinguishing, their point is that the requirements of the bankruptcy court is that it has to be sufficient to meet the standard of Rule 11. In other words, it has to be the same as a pleading. It has to be a good faith belief. There's no The representation or the implication that the bankruptcy forms have this treasure trove of either additional allegation or additional power isn't an accurate reflection of it. And again, the trial judge saw all this. The trial judge saw how they handled the other bankruptcy claims, including the non-friction claim against Quigley, and the way they handled it, you have to ask yourself, if the appellants are right when they come to this court and say these bankruptcy claim forms are the Rosetta Stone of this case, they unlock the entire trove of information, why then would they have in their hands a Quigley bankruptcy claim form and then never bother to show it to the jury, much less put it into evidence? It doesn't add up. There's no way to get from that to say, as a matter of law, we're going to overrule the trial court and say the decision, the jury would probably have made a different decision if they had had access to this document, which is substantially the same as another document.
Let's go back for a moment to the trial judge's actual ruling that resulted in your expert's testimony being admitted under Daubert. Is it correct that no one testified that friction and non-friction products are indistinguishable?
The description was correct that Dr. Dotson testified that fibers are indistinguishable under a microscope. And I think that's what he was referring to, that the fibers are the same fiber, well, the same chemical formula, and they're the same thing.
On the basis of admitting your expert's testimony under Daubert, did Judge Sykes rely on that statement in determining that your expert's proffered opinion was based on verifiable studies that would lead one to conclude that exposure to asbestos under either a surface basis or a non-friction basis were the same?
I think he relied on the statement that for the purposes of the analysis they were performing, the distinctions did not invalidate the analysis. Whatever distinctions there were, in other words, there were no relevant distinctions, which you would say is indistinguishable.
Yeah. Some people read Daubert's use of the word reliability in the expression in the opinion that reliability is something different in the law than it is in science. Some people read it to say verifiability in the scientific sense, that there are repeated studies that come up with the same result to the point where scientists can reasonably conclude that the results, because they are verifiable, are reliable. But without verifiability, there can't be reliability. What are the studies on which your expert based his opinion that would lead one to accept that conclusion?
Well, yeah, and you could call it falsifiability as well. I mean, falsifiability as opposed to verifiability, the idea that you can test the proposition and get a yes or no result. And I would point out that studies that come from the exposure perspective will tell you, and as I said, this is really a question of different ways of analyzing the problem, whether you're coming from the perspective of the exposure or from the job classification. So the studies that study job classification aren't designed to test that hypothesis and wouldn't prove it or disprove it if you wanted to. The studies that show exposure, the way epidemiologists verify or falsify a proposition is to look at the relative risk. And if you look at the relative risk at the kind of exposures that Mr. Grenier was getting under the testimony of the released respirable fibers, those are exposures are in the range where you would get the increased risk that's statistically significant, that an epidemiologist would say that's an association that supports a causal inference. Now, again, these are all inferences. There's no way to plug this into a study and get yes or no, this is a causal connection. You can only study associations between exposures and outcomes.
Well, the comment that Justice Holland read to you from Hammer, was that based upon any series of or even a single verifiable study?
It was a case study. I mean, he was talking about...
But a single case study.
Yeah. I mean, but that's not...
It doesn't meet the test of being verified.
Right, that wouldn't...
Studies that, under the same circumstances, come to the right result with a margin of error that scientists would agree was appropriate under the circumstances.
Right. The case study would be read in conjunction with the epidemiological evidence and the evidence about the correlation between the exposure and the disease. I mean, the reason the case study is relevant, and I think the reason the textbooks that we cite rely on case reports in cases of signature diseases, as you're pointing out, the reason those are relevant, they're not necessarily dispositive, they're relevant because it gives you a test case of we don't have any other exposures, we have this exposure, and we've seen this very rare outcome in this exposure. Now, you can't take a single case study and then walk in and say this proves it in all cases, but it is certainly it is not inappropriate for scientists and scientists to do. If you look at the IARC statements or any analysis of carcinogenicity of asbestos, are going to look at the case studies where it shows up in a particular occupation.
All right, thank you.
Is that my time? Thank you very much, Aaron.
With the court's permission, if I may address the point that you just raised, Chief Justice, Regarding the Daubert factors, the testability of the forms of evidence that they used, the error rate, peer review, the typical Daubert factors, if you consider the forms of evidence that the plaintiff's expert relied on, they flunk all of these factors. The only way to test whether an animal study will of a non-friction fiber, but let's pretend that it had been a friction fiber, actually would indicate a risk of mesothelioma in human is to do epidemiology. And this is the rule that the conclusion that courts addressing precisely this kind of evidence have repeatedly come to, that non-epidemiological forms of evidence typically have a very high error rate and are comparatively unreliable in comparison with epidemiology. Of course, that is not always the case. You can imagine epidemiology that is not abundant or not reliable or not done by respected research institutions. These were studies done by among the most respected research institutions in the world, Yale University, Mount Sinai Medical Center. The quibbles that Dr. Lemon lodged at these did not even bring him to testify to assert in a peer-reviewed article that they were unreliable. Rather, he characterized them as, quote, equivocal. But the concerns that he had about particular methodologies were addressed by other studies that used entirely different methodologies. And these are the very same studies that, notwithstanding that mesothelioma is a rare disease, were able to document an increased risk of contracting mesothelioma from exposure to non-friction products. When they looked at the friction products, there wasn't an association there. And no amount of discussion in scientific terms is going to come up with anything other than they're talking about non-friction product evidence. And there's no link. Ultimately, Dr. Dodson's testimony about fibers aside, there is no link between the evidence that they did bring in and the conclusions that they rendered. And I would note that in Dr. Lemon's own peer-reviewed article, he was not able to bring himself to say that the categories of evidence, exact list that I gave you earlier and that the plaintiffs had adduced at trial, of the animal studies just studying different fibers and tissue sampling and the case reports, he was not able to bring himself in his one peer-reviewed article on this subject to conclude that friction fibers do actually increase the mesothelioma. And I would submit the reason is that he couldn't do it with a straight face in front of his peers. Instead, he said that, quote, the evidence by no means exonerates friction fibers from a causal association with mesothelioma. That is a very different standard than the one that we have in a court of law. It's saying that there's no certain proof that friction fibers don't cause mesothelioma. And he, as a physician, has a hunch, a theory that they do, but he didn't bring that proof into court. In court, he brought this unreviewed opinion that, again, has not borne out with the testing that is considered the gold standard of assessment of causation.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.